This is the show your pastor warned you about.
And 1 week before Christmas, 7 days and counting, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host here on Stand to Reason. Glad you joined me. And I look forward to the next almost 2 hours of careful thinking and talking about that, those things that really matter. And a defense of classical Christianity, looking at the world from a Christian point of view, and especially promoting the idea that as a follower of Christ, you and I are his ambassadors. And so how do we make our influence best felt in our culture? That's what this show is all about. 1-800-227-5278 is my number, coast to coast. If you'd like to call from the 714 area code, that's right where I'm at here, 754-4150 is the number. And that's the number you'll have to call if you're calling from overseas, as some of you occasionally do, but we'll put you at the head of the class even though you pay the toll. I am a bit remiss here in talking about what I want to address as I start out this show 7 days before Christmas. I want to talk a little bit about Christmas cards, in particular your cards, some of which I have received. I'm remiss because I am going to offer an encouragement, shall we say, that it's going to be hard for you to employ or to act on since it's so late, unless you're one of these people who have waited to the last minute, as I often do in sending out my cards, and then maybe you can respond. This year, my wife and I, Stace, and I were totally ahead of the game, and it's been nice relaxing more as we move into the last 7 days because a lot of our big stuff is done. The out-of-state packages have been mailed. The Christmas cards went out 2 weeks ago. For the most part, all 270 of them. And so we're relaxing, but some of you may have not sent your cards out, and therefore you might want to take advantage of some of the encouragement I offer here with regards to your Christmas cards. Let's see. The background for this is kind of the concern that many people have expressed about the loss of the true meaning of Christmas, the true spirit of Christmas. I actually heard an advertisement on a program the other day in which somebody said, well, that's what the holidays are all about, after all, family and goodwill. And those are noble things, no question about it. But and maybe it is what, from a secular perspective, is the best you can expect out of Christmas nowadays. But it certainly is not what the holidays have been all about, what the true meaning of Christmas is all about. What people often say is, gee, you know, everything's so commercialized, and they're missing the true meaning of Christmas. And then you hear a comment like the one I just mentioned, family and goodwill and love or peace or joy or goodwill to men, that kind of thing. And on this view, this more exalted view of Christmas, this noble view of the virtues of Christmas, it's almost as if God was saying, hey, by golly, it's almost Christmas time. You know, that time of year, the season of giving, the season of joy and peace and goodwill towards men. Let me see, how can I celebrate there? I know what I'll do. Since that's the meaning of Christmas and giving, well, here's how I'll give. I'll become a man and sacrifice myself as a gift to mankind. That'll be my gift during this time of goodwill and earth and peace towards men. A fitting statement to the season. Now, of course, none of these things, peace and giving, etc., are pathetic in themselves. I think they turn out to be pathetic when compared with what turns out to be the real reason for the season. They pale in significance, in other words, to the event which authored Christmas 2,000 years ago. Let me underscore that. Authored Christmas. If you want to know what Christmas is about, you look at what authored the thing and what has animated Christmas for two millennia. And the point is that it's God's miraculous gift of incarnation that is not an expression of the spirit of Christmas, but is the act of giving and love and self-sacrifice and goodwill towards men from God that is the thing that is the grounds for our response to others of those same things. So if peace and joy and love and goodwill and giving of gifts has anything to do with the Christmas, it's only as a spin-off, if you will, to the point of Christmas initially. It's God's act that authored everything we understand to be the good virtues of Christmas. It's God's act that gave it substance, it gave it meaning, it gave it context, such that any appeal to those derivative things without an appeal to the central thing that makes the derivatives valuable, as valuable as the derivatives are, peace, joy, giving, and all that, it is pathetic by comparison to the initial gift. And so to talk about the so-called true meaning of Christmas, those who are trying to rescue Christmas from its commercial emphasis, and not focus on Jesus, is to admire the aroma and ignore the meal. If I can turn a literary reference on its head a bit, it's the clothes without the emperor. It reduces Christmas to packages and beautifully wrapped ribboned with nothing inside. And that is pathetic because of what's lost. It's a pathetic trade-off. So it isn't just that commercialism has taken over Christmas. It's become the winter holidays, bereft of its substance. It's that even when people try to restore its substance, they revert to not to its substance, but to the shadow of its substance. They revert to peace and joy and goodwill to men. As the announcer said, well, that's what the holidays are all about after all, family and goodwill. No, not hardly. It's about something much better than that. And I think it's our task as Christians to struggle against these other trends personally. I don't mean publicly. There's a lot of talk about how Christ is being taken out of Christmas and it's winter holidays instead of Christmas holidays. Well, those are things to take note of in the culture and try to address. But I'm really talking about on a personal basis. How do we individually enter in, participate in this holiday in a way that's deeply meaningful? That's always been a struggle for me. I mean, I'll be quite honest with you. My associations with Christmas largely were tied not to Jesus. In a peripheral sense, yes. I was in church every Christmas morning. But what really had the emotional impact for me was not Jesus, but was family, to be honest with you, and the ritual that started Christmas Eve and went well into Christmas Day. And it's a tedious, almost, ritual. If I were to retell it, I think I blogged on it last week. You can see it in our blog at str.org. And I talked about how my grandparents came out and how the mountain of presents seemed to erupt overnight from the underneath the tree. And though we were poor, it really seemed we were absolutely wealthy, and how it took us hours and hours and hours to unwrap the presents one by one. It was quite a thing. That's Christmas to me. And it's never been the same since I've grown up because I've been away from that. But I tell you one thing, my wife and I are raising little Annabeth, boy, we want her to connect emotionally with Christmas because of the reason for the season. Not love, joy, peace, and all that other stuff, but Jesus. And that whatever love and joy and goodwill that comes from the season is deeply rooted in an understanding of what the season is really about. And I'm envious of families people who have grown up with that understanding. Enforcer had more of that than I did, certainly, in her family. So some of you can say, yeah, I remember. I know what that's like, Greg, because I connect Christmas with my Lord and Savior and the Advent and the anticipation, and my heartstrings are plucked for Jesus every Christmas season. This is why we are integrating more and more things into our lives that, on a regular basis, that are meant to encourage our imaginations, if you will. It's one thing to learn theology. You can read the Christmas story, but it needs some help. And I don't mean that at all, that the Scripture isn't enough to do its job. But Lewis said you don't need just the knowledge, you need imagination. And this is why he wrote things like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, so we could take these concepts and then blend them with the imagination so that you get a not just a knowledge of it, but an understanding. You get a taste for those deep truths. You can taste them, I guess, is what I mean. And last night we went to Grace Community Church, John MacArthur's church out in the valley. And once again, now 2 years running, and we hope to make this an annual event, we went to their Christmas special, which just is a series of songs, essentially, sung by unbelievable talent that's right from that church. And it's a huge church, you know, in the Central Valley, and I mean in the Central San Fernando Valley, and so consequently, they draw from a lot of talent from the Los Angeles Basin that are part of their church, and there they are. And boy, I thought about Lewis and his imagination last evening when I listened to the way some of these Christmas carols were sung by some of the performers and the unbelievable power of these skilled people, their voices just enveloping me. I listened to a rendering of Little Drummer Boy. You know that ba-rum-ba-bum-bump, you know that song, which is a kind of nice song. But have you ever listened carefully to the words of that? It's a little boy who comes and he has nothing to offer to Jesus, so he plays on his drum and the baby smiles at him. And I listened to a characterization of that and made me weep last night. So my imagination was touched, and I need more of that, and I want more of that. We brought our little girl, and she listened. I don't think she got all of it. In fact, when the incredible tenor sang Oh Holy Night, I think it hurt her ears because just about every glass in the zip code was breaking when he hit those high notes. It was incredible. But we'll keep doing it year after year to invest her in that. And so this thought about reconnecting for myself individually, at least, and those that I have some impact on, reconnecting our emotions of Christmas with Jesus, the Advent. Now, which brings me to Christmas cards. I have been really disappointed, not just this year, but for a while now, in the cards that I have gotten from the Christians that I know. And first, a personal note, a personal comment, and this is just totally me, although maybe you'll share this, and I just want you to think about it. Here's a pet peeve. This is not the main point, but it's a little pet peeve. A lot of people send pictures of their kids for Christmas, and I don't mean a tag-along photo spread, nothing wrong with that, and I don't mean pictures of them with their kids. I mean just pictures of their kids, so I open up the letter, and I see a bunch of kids I don't recognize. Now, I don't understand this entirely, and maybe people are just so excited about their kids, they just want to put their kids in the card. I want to see mom and dad. I know mom and dad. I don't know who these kids are. Anyway, they've changed a lot since the last year, so I don't recognize them anyway. And to me, it just grates at me a little bit. So I want to see mom and dad. Now, maybe it's just me. But if you're one of those people who sends out a Christmas card with just pictures of your kids every year, you might ask your friends if they would rather see your kids or they'd rather see all of you. I like the pictures, but I want to see mom and dad in there too. Just ask them. It might be that, you know, you're more excited about your kids' photos than your friends are, right? So just a thought. Now on to the cards. Christmas is the time of year where people expect Christians to express their theological views in personal notes that are sent to everyone they know. In other words, it's the only time of the year where you can talk about Jesus in an aggressive way to all kinds of people, your Christian friends and your non-Christian friends, and they're not going to feel put out for it. As my wife said yesterday, Christmas is the one chance Christians have to get the message out loud and clear. And that's why I'm amazed at how many Christians do not take any opportunity to do that, whatever, in their Christmas cards. And so I have two piles of Christmas cards here. First pile from a lot of Christian people I know who sent me their cards. A lot of them have pictures of kids on it too, but some have pictures of families, which are great. But it's what the cards say. Holiday wishes From Our Home to Yours, 2005. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year with love. Well, he said Christmas. All right. Season's greetings with a picture of the whole family. That's it. Now, there's a personal note written, but it's a personal note. It's have a blessed Christmas. Here's another family photo. From our home to yours, Merry Christmas. Here's one. It says Merry Christmas on the cover, wishing you a Merry, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. On the cover is a beautiful picture of Santa Claus. Another one from some very fine Christian friends we have. Season's greetings. Here's another picture. A couple of kids with Santa Claus and Mrs. Santa. Merry Christmas. May all your seasons be filled with peace and joy. It's nice. Here's a picture with a kid and a Santa Claus over kid. Well, season's greetings. Now, I expect season's greetings from atheists. I don't expect season's greetings from Christians. I expect some reference to Jesus. Especially since we are the first, aren't we, to complain about how Jesus is being taken out of Christmas? Well, why isn't he in your card? That's the first stack. Got more like this. And by the way, I appreciate the cards. I'm glad to hear from my friends. I'm just mystified why these very committed Christians make no mention of Jesus in their Christmas cards. Here's another. The good pile. On the cover, just a bow, kind of, with the hearts dangling from the bow, like a Christmas, looks like a Christmas present that's wrapped. The card does. And then it says, Jesus is the gift that perfectly fits the size of every heart. Inside, may all that he is bring you all that you need at Christmas and throughout the new year. And then a verse from Philippians underneath. And a personal note. Now, this is not fancy, but it's totally appropriate. Now, maybe people don't pay attention to that. All they just read, they look for the name. But at least you give them a chance to pay attention to something. At least you give them a message that the Spirit can use, something to ponder during this time. You never know. I wonder how many people, if anybody listening, was ever, as a non-believer, deeply touched by a card. Now, my wife and I go way out of our way. She hand-makes all the cards. It's definitely a kind of a, you know, nativity scene type deal. And we have our personal note letter thing inside, you know, that we print out with pictures. But there's always some kind of lucid explanation on the significance of Christmas. In fact, this Christmas was more lucid. In fact, I can't read it to you because you'd probably fall. There's so much there. We give a whole testimony deal in our card. Why? Because we want people to think. Maybe just for one time the whole year in a productive, clear way about the Savior whose birth we celebrate. Here's one. It has three kings on the front. Three kings came with the treasures of earth in their hands and left with the treasure of heaven in their hearts. And you open it up and it says, celebrating this Christmas because Jesus still gives us the greatest treasure of all, himself. Blessings to you. And signed by my friends, then the verse from Matthew 6:21, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. This very nice card, really focusing well, and also, by the way, from a very wealthy family who gives the bulk of their income away to charity and ministry. Here's one that has a little baby on the front, simply divine, it says underneath, and as you open up, may your Christmas be a time to reflect on the simplicity of his birth and the magnitude of his purpose. Another card here, close friend, includes the Jesus, our God and Savior, one solitary life printed out for us to read. You know that. Another one somebody has written in, Merry Christmas, but then underneath, seek after, this by written by hand, seek after the things of Christ in his love, and the family who sent it. And then finally, just for your example, a small, simple, sublime card has a trumpeting angel on the front, kind of a medieval print type look to it, Christmas greetings, and then inside, handwritten, the herald angels proclaim the hope of mankind consummated in Jesus. Merry Christmas. That from the Enforcer, by the way. All of those. Take a moment at least to reflect on the point of Christmas. Take a moment to draw our attention for each person who opens that note to the point of Christmas. And who knows what the Holy Spirit is going to do with that? I don't know. Maybe he won't do anything, but at least I've given him something to work with, haven't I? At least I've acknowledged as a believer that this is what I think is the most important thing about Christmas. Please don't send out a card that says Happy Holidays. Don't send out a card that just says Merry Christmas. Send out a card that says something in some way about Jesus, the reason for the season. All this to say that if Christ is going out of Christmas, it may be partly our fault as Christians, because the simplest way we have to profess him, we have abandoned many times. 1-800-227-5278, and that's my number. If you're in the 714 area, code 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason.
For 2,000 years, the Church has been standing strong in a desperate battle for the souls of men. Each era has its own particular challenges or battlefield, yet our means and weapons should always be the same. Yet what is unique about today's conflict is that much of the Church is fighting the wrong battle with the wrong weapons. In this two-lecture set, Greg calls the Church back to the basics of genuine spiritual warfare, truth encounters, not power encounters, from truth to experience. Why the Church is losing its vitality in the 21st century is this important teaching. Call 1-800-2-REASON to order, 1-800-2-REASON, or go to the web at str.org to order From Truth to Experience.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. All right, Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And being the end of the year, that means the beginning of the year is right around the corner. And at the beginning of the year, we always have our Master Series of Christian Thought. And we'll be starting January 9th through February 6th at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach, the standard venue. We've been there for years and years. In fact, before we even started Stand to Reason. And I'd like to extend an invitation to you to be a part of that whole series, five different talks. And here's the lineup we have. Kicking off January 9th, Jay Budziszewski, What We Can't Not Know. January 16th, Dr. Frank Beckwith, and his talk is called Sex in the City. That would be S-E-C-T-S. The Problem of Believing Something. January 23rd, Dr. J. Wesley Richards of the Discovery Institute, and he'll be talking about the death of materialism, evidence of intelligent design from cosmology to capitalism. January 30th, Dr. Paul Meyer, Christianity, the First Three Centuries. He's new in our venue, and he's really, really great. He's written quite a number of kind of Christian historical fiction stuff about the first century. He's an expert. He's brilliant. You'll really like him. And then I'll be anchoring the team on February 6th with a talk, Truth is a Strange Sort of Fiction. I'll be talking about understanding the emerging culture and the emerging church. That all starting January 9th. The series is $30 for the series and $7 for each individual session. You can go to our website. We have information there. You can call Hope Chapel, area code 310-374-4673 to register if you'd like to in advance. It's always good if we register in advance. We know how many people are coming, but it's going to be a great series, and I hope to see you there. Starting January 9th at 7 in the evening, so get there early for parking and for seating. Stand to Reasons and Hope Chapel's Master's Series in Christian Thought. One more think, no, I'll save that for later. Time to go to the show and to the calls on the show. Rachel, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you.
I'm all confused here, aren't I?
Tuned in a little late, but you're talking about cards.
I was, yes.
I had to hunt quite a bit for biblically-based nativity scene cards.
Uh-huh. Somebody else mentioned the same thing.
Pardon me?
Somebody else mentioned the same thing. It's getting harder and harder to find.
It
Although
is.
I think if people bought more of those things, they'd probably produce more. But
yes. Well, I found some beautiful ones after hunting a while. But I've done something more. I have put in every card a little note.
Mm-hmm.
Defy the Marxist ACLU, etc. Say Merry Christmas. And I'm wondering what kind of a feedback I'm going to get because I'm sending it to Christians and non-Christian friends.
Well, yeah, it's maybe a little strong. I like the idea of saying Merry Christmas. In fact, when somebody says to me, like a vendor or a clerk or something, says Merry Christmas to me, I say Merry Christmas back, and then I say thank you for not saying Happy Holidays. Because there is such a politically correct pressure now just to reduce Christmas to the holidays, and so that's what I try to do. So I'm glad you're emphasizing that. I'm not sure when you say resist the Marxist ACLU if that's going to impress your non-Christian friends, but
I think it will. Some the conservative ones.
Oh yeah, well the conservatives.
I'd like to wake
right.
a few people up.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing that and let the chips fall where they may.
There you go. Okay, Rachel, thanks for the tip.
Thank you, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome. You know, I mentioned that I was remiss in starting in giving my comments about Christmas cards so late in the season because most of you have already sent your cards out. But all those cards that you could have sent out this year, you can still send out next year, and they're all going to be on sale next week. So you might just peruse the stores a bit and get a whole bunch of those good cards with the good statements and some reference to Jesus in the next couple of weeks and prepare in advance for next year. Okay, let's go back to Japan. And Stephen, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello, Greg.
Yes, I'm sorry. Last week I didn't get to your question. You had sent us a question, and I was supposed to talk about it, but I didn't get it. So here you are.
Oh, really? Was it me?
Well, it's somebody from Japan. Are you in Okinawa?
No, I'm not.
Oh, that's a different. That's a different listener from Japan.
Yeah.
Okay, you sent in a question. I'll have to answer it later. But go ahead. What's on your mind today, Steve?
From Okinawa, though. Yeah, Merry Christmas, Greg. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Yeah, not Happy Holiday, but
yes, right.
Christians should greet Merry Christmas.
Yes.
I know you're kind of busy to you know answer other calls, but I want to give you my little piece of my mind before I go to my.
All right.
Would that be all right?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, reflecting to your last week's comments concerning capital punishment, I just want to ask you about something that was a little, stumbled by, and I want to...
Okay. Yeah. You want my response to it? Is that what you said?
I'm sorry?
You want my response to it?
Yeah, I want you to respond to this.
Okay, give it a shot here, and I'll do my best.
Thank you. Yeah, please correct me if I'm wrong, but, I think this way. Since our sins are covered by the blood of Jesus, we are forgiven as his followers, and shouldn't our behavior reflect that?
Well, yes.
I mean, in terms of giving mercy to others whenever it depends on us. And if we don't, would that be biblically unethical?
Well, no, I think your point is a good one, but your application is not sound, is what I'd have to say. Because there's two ways to reason this. One of them is the ethic that we are to follow as individuals when we are personally wronged. The same ethic that the culture should follow when someone assaults the culture. In other words, should the government follow the same principles as a governing body when there is a crime against it, the society as a whole?
Yeah, I agree.
For an individual.
I'm not arguing for... total inaction towards evil. I mean, I'm not arguing for pacifism.
Yeah, like as George Bush said when he was...
Whenever it depends on us, what I mean? For example, if it was up to me, how should I respond? What kind of punishment should I make? I mean, I'm not judge. I'm not, law enforcement officer or anything
right.
like that.
Right. I guess that...
Whenever it depends on me, how should I act?
If somebody assaulted you...
Yeah.
A criminal assaulted you.
Right.
It would be appropriate for you to personally forgive that person and not take personal retaliation. And I think this is what's going on in Matthew chapter 5. However, when Jesus said, turn the other cheek kind of thing
right.
and forgive your enemies, the general thing
of
forgive your enemies, but it would be also be perfectly appropriate. In fact, it's a good thing for the government then to exercise its justice against that person, to punish that person for what he did, and also to hopefully protect others from that same individual who might do it to others as well. I don't think you're obliged as a Christian to say, okay, you stole my car, or you beat up my kids, or you, you know, hurt me, so therefore I am not, there is no appropriate redress from government against your actions. Somebody who assaulted. Now, you may choose in some circumstances not to press charges and to forgive that person and not allow charges to be pressed against them. And I think there's there is a place for that. I don't think you're obliged by any of the teachings of Christ to do that, though.
I mean, in light of you know, Christian belief, you know, how should we respond?
Well, I think you can
biblically correct, you know.
Well, if the person, the biblical condition is if a person repents, you forgive them. Generally, in a case where somebody's assaulted you, you're not facing somebody who's repented. If somebody comes to you with a repentant stage of mind, then you personally forgive them, and you no longer hold that against them in terms of your personal relationship. But it may still be the case that the state takes its action against that person for its own reasons.
Okay. I just want to emphasize, whenever it depends on us, you know, state it's state, you know, law it's law.
Right.
Whenever we
Fair
can
enough.
Do, how should we react?
Fair enough. Okay, you
anyway,
have a second issue.
That was my question. My question was you know, a little bit different from my
comment.
What would be a legitimacy of whole Pentecostal and charismatic movement, you know, in terms of their miracles and ability of speaking, you know, tongues, healing sick, fixing broken families, you know, so on and so forth?
Well,
you know, I happened to witness recently that, you know, Some of those took place, and I'm wondering by what you know, spirit or you know by what.
Sure. When you say you witnessed it taking place, you're saying you witnessed speaking in tongues and prophecy or miracles.
Well, I you know here like I'm witnessing speaking tongues all the time because I live nearby. Korean kind of charismatic church.
Sure.
Although they claim to be Baptist, but that's the case.
Yeah. Okay.
But I witnessed that recently. I know personally folks that, you know, that they were pretty in bad shape. I mean, in the couples and then suddenly they went to their church and you know everything started going well, and I was wondering what kind of.
Okay. Well, let me give you my perspective here without addressing any particular charismatic church.
That's what I need to know.
Right. I was a pastor in a charismatic church for 8 years. You need to know that. There was a four-square church, and it's classical Pentecostal church. Now, our particular congregation was not the run-of-the-mill Pentecostal congregation. It was more toned down in certain ways. But in any event, I am not hostile towards the idea of the exercise of the charismata, the so-called supernatural gifts of the Spirit, word of knowledge, word of prophecy, tongues with interpretations, and miracles of different sorts. In principle, I am not against them. I don't think that the arguments that have been advanced, that these are gifts that were sign gifts only meant for a certain period of time, which have died out naturally after the first century, I do not think that those arguments are persuasive. So I will say I have no good theological reason to believe that there cannot be legitimate manifestations of those gifts in local churches today. However, having said that, and having been in charismatic circles for much of my life, I don't know that I've ever heard a real prophecy, even though I've heard dozens, if not hundreds, of prophecies in my time as a Christian, or alleged prophecies. I don't know if I've ever heard a real one where this was really God speaking. There have been many times where I've been involved in charismatic churches where I saw a disrespect for the gifts and an abuse of the gifts, where people are speaking in tongues without interpreters, which it seems to me is directly prohibited by Paul in 1 Corinthians 14.
Right.
I have almost never seen any charismatic church that ever took the time to write a single prophecy down. And this you'll find by charismatic churches across the board. They revel in this prophetic revelation, but they never write it down and they never test their prophets. Now, when I say never, it's a generalization. There are exceptions to this, but most of the time, anybody who says, "Thus saith the Lord," they'll never get questioned. They'll just be listened to, and people say, "Praise the Lord, hallelujah," when they're done. And so there's not a testing of the prophets or the prophecy, and people who give false prophecies are not silenced. So I don't think that even charismatics have taken their prophetic words and tongues and interpretations very seriously. I think they have a frivolous attitude in spite of the fact that they're charismatic groups. So you
kind of assume that it's more like an emotional response rather than...
It may be. I don't know. I just, if charismatic churches really believe in charismatic gifts, they should operate the charismatic gifts with the sense of gravity and care that the scriptures present them with. Therefore, if you have someone speaking a tongue, you should have an interpreter, or the person with the tongue should be silent. You should have a few prophecies given. The prophecies should be tested. Now, you can't test a prophecy. You test the prophet by the prophecy. If the prophecy is a false prophecy, the prophet is a false prophet. There is nothing like prophets who get some right and some wrong. That's Gene Dixon, who is 100% right 70% of the time. Those are false prophets. True biblical prophets are always right in everything, right, every single time. And so...
I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, and so these things need to be tested. And that means, minimally, it seems, that whatever prophecy is uttered should be written down, should be dated, and the person who prophesied should be identified with the prophecy. And then the prophecy should be tested. And maybe it's going to be a wait and see that if the prophecy comes true, or maybe people can leadership can pray and assess what they consider the value of the prophecy to be or the legitimacy, but it's got to be assessed. And I would say any charismatic group that does not do that as a bare minimum does not get my respect as being genuinely biblically charismatic.
What about other manifestations? I'm not talking about prophecy in particular, but what about healing sick?
Well, I don't know why anybody would
all that stuff. I mean, by what spirit? I mean, if that's the case, if those miracles are real, then would that be fair to say that maybe there is an evil spirit involved?
Well, I think when we argue this way, we're up against the logic of Jesus. If Satan cast out demons by the ruler of demons, I mean, if people cast out demons by the ruler of demons, then Satan is divided against himself. And so if we're saying people are getting healed by, I mean, I think there can be false healings and stuff like that, but if we're arguing that way, then we run into this problem, and it makes us suspicious of everything, when maybe, in fact, the Holy Spirit is moving. I think if you've got the gospel being proclaimed in truth, and you have miraculous manifestations that are quantifiable, I don't see any reason, that are giving glory to God, I don't see any reason not to think that this is from God. I mean, if somebody gets healed, why not say, give God the benefit of the doubt and say, praise the Lord? If there's a real healing. Now, I think the so-called healings of the Benny Hinn crowd are a bunch of phonies. And there's been a lot of documentation to this effect. You know, this is a very carefully orchestrated stage enterprise that's just entertainment. It's just a bunch of hooey. And all these so-called documented healings, a lot of these people are dropped dead the next day. So, those aren't bona fide healings. But if you have a bona fide healing, the real McCoy, I don't see any reason to doubt that that's from God when it's done in the name of Jesus and to his glory. So I'm open to that.
Keeping in mind what Jesus said, there would be like false Jesuses or...
That's true, right. And they will work signs miracles and wonders,
I mean,
yeah.
Real miracles in the sense of its reality.
That's right. Matthew 24, he talks about that. Yes.
Right. So how would you interpret in light of that?
Well, this is where you've got to look beyond the alleged miracle and look at the content of the things that are being said. Remember, he said these will be false messiahs that will work signs and wonders to mislead, if possible, even the elect. And so these false messiahs are going to be characterized not by their miraculous activity, but by their teaching, what they say. And this is why it's important for us to look at the doctrine of a lot of these people who are allegedly doing miracles, and not just at the miracle. The miracle itself.
And also, I believe Paul said we have to distinct spirits. We have to tell difference. We have to know the difference between spirits.
Yeah, but the way to know the difference between spirits is not through some subjectivistic. Gee, it just seems they're not right. When John says to test the spirits, he gave an objective test. And he was talking there about spirits of the Gnostics. Anybody who says that Jesus Christ has not come in the flesh is not of God. So testing of the spirits is not some kind of a Twilight Zone subjectivistic thing. It's like, oh, I don't bear witness kind of thing. No, you've got to ask some questions. you have to look at the content of the teaching. And so I actually think testing of the spirits is by content, because that's what John offered in 1 John. Listen, Stephen, we're up against a break. I'm going to have to go.
All right. Okay. Oh, yeah. I won't keep you anymore.
Does that help you?
Thanks for your time, Greg.
You're very welcome. And
if you have some time, could you kind of keep on this thought a little bit? I'll be listening.
Okay. Yeah, we'll be taking some other calls, but if it comes up again, I'll give some more information.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. And going to break here on Stand to Reason. Back in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel.
You know the feeling: unsure, tentative. You remain quiet, or you're just angry. The feeling you get whenever the conversation turns to your faith and values. Want to increase your confidence and skill in discussions and feel confident when you speak up? Then tactics is for you. Learn the techniques Greg Kokel has taught thousands of others that will help put you in the driver's seat in every exchange. You'll learn specific skills to help you initiate conversations effortlessly. Stop challengers in their tracks and turn the tables. Graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, and present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. You'll learn some simple tactics and skills that will have you interacting and conversing with confidence about what you believe and why. Tactics will teach you how, as you listen and follow along while Greg walks you step by step through the material as your personal tutor. Soon, your conversations with friends will look more like diplomacy than warfare, and you'll be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present your faith and the reasons why Jesus Christ is the answer. Call 1-800-2-REASON to order. 1-800-2-REASON. Or go to the web at str.org.
Joy to the world!
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. You almost don't want to interrupt that. It's so nice. And I said it was so great to go to Grace Community Church last night and hear these magnificent songs sung in a most magnificent way and join the truth with our imagination here. Is that Rosemary Clooney? Yeah. Join the truth, in a sense, the facts of the truth, with your imagination. That is the creativity of the arts to help you experience that truth in an entirely new way. We had another caller that calls in from Japan. We just had one from Japan, and we have another one that calls in. But he asked a question that was similar. He asked me to address it. He actually phoned this into the office, I think. It has to do with this broader issue of how is the Holy Spirit working now in the 21st century? What does Greg think about God giving us visions in order to give them to other people in this day and age? And I suspect that part of the question has to do with my concern about the whole movement, the hearing from the voice of God movement, the idea that every Christian can get private personal revelations from God, and this is variously characterized as being led by the Spirit or hearing the voice of God or listening prayer. You pray and talk to God, then you quiet yourself and listen as God talks to you. I don't think any of those things are biblical, in the way that they're taught, at least. But it's not coming from a hostility to the idea of God giving special revelation in this day and age. I'm not a cessationist. That is, I don't believe that the miraculous working of God ceased in the first century. As I mentioned in my last caller, I don't have any biblical reason to believe that supernatural giftings cannot be manifest. I believe in principle in tongues with interpretations and special prophecies, and I think there's other motifs or modes of spiritual communication that God can use to his people, which would include visions, and, you know, any of a number of other things, dreams, that we see as biblical modes in the Scriptures. I'm not objecting to that. My objection to things, this trend nowadays, is that everybody has a right, biblically speaking, and can expect to receive direct special revelation from God in one of these forms. That this is the birthright of every Christian, that we're all prophets or can be. That we all can hear from God. This is not biblical. And in fact, I think it's dangerous. I'm not going to go into all the details now. I've talked about that in other times, and if you want to call and talk about it, we can. But in responding to this question, it does not at the same time mean that I don't think that God can give a vision to someone or give a prophecy to someone for someone else. I just think that when somebody claims to speak for God, having received a vision or a prophecy or anything like that, that it is a very weighty thing to claim that God is speaking through you. It is an extraordinary claim. It requires adequate justification, and the default position isn't to believe whatever anybody says just because they said God told them. If somebody said, God has this word from me to you, my question is, why should I believe that? Why should I trust that you speak for God right now? Now, it may be they can give me reasons, but they need to. If someone says, I have had a vision for you from God, my question would be the same. Why should I trust that your vision is an authoritative vision? That's what it means to test the prophets, ladies and gentlemen, and to test the prophecies. They are not to be accepted out of hand. They are to be, I think, rather we should be skeptical of such a claim, and it's guilty until proven innocent rather than the other way around. So to answer the question simply, giving us visions in order to give them to other people in this day and age? I think he can do this in any day and age. I think it's remarkable for him to do this in any day and age. That is, it's unusual. Even in the Bible, it was unusual, ladies and gentlemen. For most of the stretch of biblical history, these things weren't happening. And even when they were happening, they weren't happening among everybody, only among isolated people who had very specific jobs to do in the kingdom. And so I think we should have a sober attitude about this. We should be open to the possibility, and we should test rigorously the claims that people make when they claim that God has spoken through them. So that's my view. Let's see. Back to the phones. Mike, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi. I have a question about Mark and Luke, but before I ask that, may I ask if you – do you have any lectures that deal with the Da Vinci Code?
I don't. We have a piece on our website at str.org. I think we still have it, that came out when the book came out, and it's written by someone else. I didn't write it, but quite a number of people have done a lot of work on the Da Vinci Code material, and this has a lot of stuff on it, and there's been some new works unraveling the Da Vinci Code, or something like that. There's about five books that have titles something like that that are written by Christian scholars.
Well, that's fine. I was just looking at something specifically for you.
We'll probably do something in more detail on it in the next few months just because the movie's coming out.
Right.
Although the Enforcer just bought me the CDs of the Da Vinci Code, so I can listen to it in the car while I'm driving and read it that way because my time is kind of taken up with other things right now. So I'm planning to actually, in a sense, read the book myself in the next few months. So I could speak more authoritatively on it. The problem with the Da Vinci Code is that it's fiction. It's just fiction, and people don't think it is. They think it's fact, or they think it's faction. That is, it's an interesting story that has fictional elements, but it's built on a structure of truth. And this, nothing could be further from the truth on that. It's been shown, demonstrated clearly that even the whole concept of the Da Vinci Code is a fabrication from the past that has been resurrected, so to speak. And the appeal to the so-called documents of the past and the Gospel of Philip or whoever, you know, whichever pseudepigraph of false writings are appealed to in this book are just spurious. They have no grounds in history, and it's interesting that these people who write these kinds of things put more credibility on the spurious pseudepigrapha, the false writings of the 2nd through the 4th or 5th or 6th centuries about Jesus than they do on the canonical Gospels that are written early by people who lived with Jesus. It's just amazing. But anyway, there's a thumbnail sketch. It's just fiction. It's not fact.
Thank you. Recently, I heard a lecture with Lee Strobel, and he was making several arguments, one of which was trying to get the date of the cross closer, the written books closer and closer to the cross. He made the comment...
The date of the writing of the Gospels closer to the cross.
Closer to the cross.
Gotcha.
And he made the comment that Luke quoted Mark. Any idea what how come Mark didn't quote Luke?
Well, there's a problem in gospel studies that's called the synoptic problem. Have you ever heard that phrase?
I've heard synoptic, but not synoptic problem.
Well, synoptic means same look or same eye.
Right.
And they call the synoptic gospels Matthew, Mark, and Luke
right.
the synoptics because they have a lot of overlapping information. However, in other words, the wording in many is almost exactly the same in many cases. When you go to the Gospel of John, you have a ton of unique material. Now, people who like to slice and dice these things and like engineer types who want to sift through the words, they've been able to isolate, they've been able to see relationships between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the relationship is that Matthew and Luke seem to be quoting from Mark and also from another, then they have a grouping of sayings that are similar to each of them, but not in Mark. And this comes, they think they're quoting another source that no longer is in existence. And this,
that's the proverbial Q document.
Exactly, because the word, it comes from the word quell or kuel, or I don't know how to pronounce it actually, Q-E-U-L-L-E or whatever, which is a German word for source, and so they just identify it by the first letter Q. And so the synoptic problem is trying to figure out what is in fact the literary relationship between all these documents. Was there ever a Q? Did Matthew and Matthew and Luke borrow from Mark in this way or whatever. And so the way it looks is it looks as if Mark was the first document. It's the shortest gospel. And that Matthew and Luke borrowed some from that for their own work. They used existing sources and added some of their own materials as well, their own observations and their own research. And maybe they drew from another piece called Q. There are lots of interesting ways to kind of address this problem. What doesn't follow, it seems to me, from the synoptic problem is the idea that you can't trust the gospel accounts either as historical documents or as being inspired documents, that is, God-breathed, God being involved, just because they used each other as sources. Luke says he used other sources. This isn't due damage to our view that God was working through these men in order to produce the final product. So I think that the problem that people are concerned with is that they think this somehow undermines the authority of the Gospels or the writers, and I don't see how it does at all. But there is it's an interesting academic enterprise to try to figure out how these books relate to each other in a literary fashion. I think the standard view is that Mark was the first Gospel, and that probably Matthew followed, and then Luke came after that. John, universally accepted as being the latest, and Mark, pretty universally accepted as being the earliest. Now, what's interesting about the dating, and I don't know, maybe this is the thing that Lee Strobel was getting at, and this is an argument that I used when I was in my TV debate with Deepak Chopra, and he was arguing that the Gospels were late. My argument was, look at Luke wrote the Gospel of Luke, and he wrote the Book of Acts. This is uncontested. The Book of Acts ends in 62 A.D. with the Apostle Paul in his first imprisonment. Now, he was executed in 64 under Nero, but his first imprisonment was 60 to 62. And he's still in prison at this time when the account ends and Luke is with him. Now, the question is, why does Luke stop there? Because in the Gospel of Luke, he claims he has Jesus predicting the destruction of the temple, Luke 21, which happened in 70 A.D. Now, you'd think if Luke was writing a history of the early church and the temple was destroyed, he would mention that. But he doesn't. And so this suggests not only that he's writing before the temple was destroyed, but he is also writing before Paul is dead, which puts the writing of the book of Acts between 60 and 62, which is Paul's first imprisonment, where the book abruptly ends. So if Luke has written the book of Acts in 60 or 62, he wrote his gospel before that. And if Mark and Matthew wrote before Luke, then each of them wrote before 60 A.D., probably mid-50s somewhere, which puts the full writing of the Gospels, at least a couple of them, within 20 years of the death of Christ. And that's pretty impressive. Got to go, Mike, and thanks for the call. 1 hour ahead of us, or most of it at least, here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us for hour number two. I'm Greg Kokel. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, our second hour today. And if you missed the first hour, too bad. You can download it tomorrow. We've got a lot of activity on our website on Mondays because people are downloading MP3 files of our show. It's going to be there. Of course, we are live streaming, that is, on your computer. Go to www.kbrt740.com, kbrt740.com. That's our parent station here. We're broadcasting from 16 years, and I think we start our 17th year of broadcasting in February. Holy cow. You know, I just realized something, ladies and gentlemen, that there are some young people out there whose parents are deeply committed to this show. And you know who you are. Wives have told me that I've kind of ruined their weekends because dad has to get his fix, excuse me, every weekend. So does mom sometime. But though the kids are in on it too. So that there are kids that are like 20 years old who for their entire lives, since they probably don't remember much before they were four, have been exposed to this radio program. That's kind of neat. It's amazing to think that much time has gone by. Let's see. I want to start out, if you saw in People Magazine, not People Magazine, but what's that thing, that Parade Magazine that comes in the LA Times Sundays, or your own paper around the country, they had the worst and best. And here's the best reward, and I have a particular personal reason for mentioning this. It's from Lakeland, Florida. A homeless mother's luck changed when she found a bag containing $800 that a Lakeland sheriff's deputy accidentally left on the hood of her car. She's homeless but had a car, I guess. Maybe that's where she was living. I don't know. Anyway, Kenesha Blackman, 24, and they have her picture here, turned it in without a second thought. Good for her. $800 sitting there. The homeless woman turned it in. It's not my money, she thought. Good for her. Now, after her story was published, listen to this, calls poured in, and so far $30,000 has been donated to a fund for her. It's a blessing, says Blackman, I guess so, who now has housing. As for those who have been generous to her, I just want to tell them thank you. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. It's a good story. And I want to say thank you, and this is the personal element, to whoever it is that picked up my bag of goodies over at Home Depot. I had about six of them. I was there yesterday, loading my car. And I left a bag on the tarmac there and drove away without it. How did I do that? I don't know. And when I got home, I realized, hey, I'm missing my stuff. And I drove all the way back, praying every mile. And sure enough, somebody had picked up the bag and turned it in to Lost and Found. Of course, you can't do much with plumber's putty and kind of a saw blade and a faucet and stuff like that. But I'm glad they did, so my thanks to whoever did that. Now, I don't want you to miss the significance of what I said right at the end of last hour. The caller asked some questions about the timing of the gospel writing, and the argument that I offered placed the writing of the three gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, by 62 A.D., Jesus was crucified 33 to 62. That's less than 30 years for all three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And it's probably less than that if Luke was written in 62 or thereabouts, and that would be the book of Acts written then, and Luke, which predates it, was written early 60s or late 50s, then Matthew, and certainly Mark, which came before Luke, it seems, was written mid-50s, which means 20 years or so after the events themselves. This is really unbelievable, especially for all of those authors who want to late date the Gospels to be able to remove from them the sense of authority they get as accurate accounts of history because they were written by eyewitnesses and close to the time the events happened. Now, along with that, I just learned the other day, although some of you might have heard this, that Anne Rice, the famous novelist who wrote Interviews with a Vampire and a bunch of other ghoulish things, that Interviews was made into a movie with Tom Cruise years back, Anne Rice has now become a believer. She's written a new book called Christ the Lord Out of Egypt. She writes these historical novels and does a lot of research, and so apparently she thought about writing one about Jesus in the first century, so she read everything she could get her hands on. And in this book, Christ the Lord Out of Egypt, she has kind of an afterword or an author's comment or an author's note. Go to the bookstore. You can just pick it up and page to the back, and you'll get 15 to 20 pages of her own journey as a novelist doing research on the question that my caller raised last hour. Can you trust the Gospels? When were they written? And I just want to read some of the comments that she made, Anne Rice. Huge commercial success as a writer. What she says about her journey. And so I'm just reading excerpts that the Enforcer has put together for me. Here's what she says. her late husband was a very committed atheist, and she had made a journey from Catholicism, I think, to atheism, to skepticism, and then back to a commitment to Christ, the Christ of history. Having started, she writes, with the skeptical critics, those who take their cue from the earliest skeptical New Testament scholars of the Enlightenment, I expected to discover that their arguments would be frighteningly strong. This would be the liberal critics of the New Testament. And that Christianity was at heart a kind of fraud. I'd have to end up compartmentalizing my mind with faith in one part of it and truth in another. It's what Schaeffer called the upper story leap. She says these skeptical scholars seem so very sure of themselves. They built their books on certain assumptions, but without even examining those assertions. What gradually came clear to me was that many of the skeptical arguments, arguments that insisted most of the Gospels were suspect, for instance, or written too late to be eyewitness accounts, these arguments lacked coherence. They were not elegant. Arguments about Jesus himself were full of conjecture. Some books were no more than assumptions piled upon assumptions. Absurd conclusions were reached on the basis of little or no data at all. In other words, friends, as she's starting to do her research, fully expecting to find the current so-called scholarship on the life of Jesus compelling, powerful, and the beliefs of religious people just myths, she found just the opposite to her surprise, as a skeptic herself. In sum, she writes, the whole cause for the non-divine Jesus who stumbled into Jerusalem and somehow got crucified by nobody and had nothing to do with the founding of Christianity and would be horrified by it if he knew about it, that whole picture, which had floated in the liberal circles I frequented as an atheist for 30 years, that case was not made. A remarkable understatement there, isn't it? That case was not made. Not only was it not made, I discovered in this field some of the worst and most biased scholarship I'd ever read. I saw almost no skeptical scholarship that was convincing. All these skeptics insisted that the Gospels were late documents, that the prophecies in them had been written after the fall of Jerusalem. But the more I read about the fall of Jerusalem, the more I couldn't understand this. The way the skeptics put this issue aside, they simply assumed the Gospels were late documents because of these prophecies in the Gospels. And this does not begin to convince. I was able to enter the fourth Gospel. In other words, after her assessment of the liberal critics' scholarship and arguments, and being utterly disappointed with the work that they'd done, though she was fully willing to believe it if she had gotten something substantial. She now has, in a sense, this liberal bias removed. So in doing her own research for her own work, she writes now, "I was able to enter the fourth Gospel and see Jesus alive and moving," this being the Gospel of John. "And what eventually emerged for me from the Gospels was their unique coherence, their personalities, the inevitable stamp of individual authorship. Not a bunch of inventions by the church that were pieced together hundreds of years later. Rather, the fact that each was the function of an individual author," is what she's saying. And she closes, "Now, somewhere during my journey through all of this, as I became disillusioned with the skeptics and with the flimsy evidence for their conclusions, I realized something about my book, and it was this. The challenge was to write about the Jesus of the Gospels," of course, with an exclamation point. And it's interesting. It reminds me of Frank Morrison, Who Moved the Stone. You know, he went out to disprove Christianity and then wrote in favor of it after he gathered the evidence, and he was so compelled by it. His first chapter is the book that wouldn't be written. So Rice now apparently is writing about the significance of the fall of Jerusalem and how this actually helps to argue for an early dating of the Gospels. So, and that was basically the argument I made at the end of last hour here. The book she's written, again, Christ the Lord Out of Egypt, I haven't read it. I don't know anything about her. Her name is vaguely familiar, but many of you have read her books, I'm sure, because she's sold millions, and she is a major mover in her field, and took up the task of writing about the first century, and in her research was completely unmoved, in fact, contemptuous for the poor scholarship of the liberal skeptics of the New Testament, and has made her own commitment based on her convictions about the truthfulness of the Gospels and the historical reliability of those things. Going to break and then back with your calls. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
You know the feeling, unsure, tentative, you remain quiet, or you're just angry. The feeling you get whenever the conversation turns to your faith and values. Want to increase your confidence and skill in discussions and feel confident when you speak up? Then Tactics is for you. Learn the techniques Greg Kokel has taught thousands of others that will help put you in the driver's seat in every exchange. You'll learn specific skills to help you initiate conversations effortlessly. Stop challengers in their tracks and turn the tables. Graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, and present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. You'll learn some simple tactics and skills that will have you interacting and conversing with confidence about what you believe and why. Tactics will teach you how, as you listen and follow along while Greg walks you step by step through the material as your personal tutor. Soon, your conversations with friends will look more like diplomacy than warfare, and you'll be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present your faith and the reasons why Jesus Christ is the answer. Call 1-800-2-REASON to order. 1-800-2-REASON. Or go to the web at str.org.
And the show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host. That's so nice, isn't it? 1-800-227-5278. I'll be getting to the calls in just a moment. I just spoke to you about Anne Rice and her reflections on the Gospels and their historical reliability in light of her own research. She went to write this book, of course, with the eye of a researcher, because she's well known for doing historical novels in which her research is assiduous, very careful. I think that's especially notable then, the conclusion that she came to. The Enforcer is going to post on this tomorrow, this piece that I read, which was an excerpt from a number of pages of writing of Anne Rice's from the back of her book, Christ the Lord Out of Egypt, when she talks about her own journey here. That'll be posted, so you're welcome to read that in a post tomorrow at str.org on the blog. And was I supposed to say something else about that? Okay. To the phones, then. And let's talk to, is it Zeb?
Yes.
Like
Greg.
As in Zebulun?
As in Zebulun, correct.
Okay, nice to talk to you, Zeb.
You too, Greg. It's a great pleasure to talk to you. I've been listening for about 5 years.
Wow.
And just downloading. I haven't had a Sunday off in about 5 years. So first time I've actually been able to speak to you. So.
Well, I'm glad you called. Thanks, Zeb.
I got two pretty quick, easy ones. The first one is, I've found myself working at a casino in my career endeavors.
You found yourself? You just woke up one day and there you were?
Yeah. Well, no, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Okay.
But it's pretty much the best that I can do right now while I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up.
Mm-hmm.
In college. So, but my mom gives me a hard time every once in a while, you know, about, you know, you're a Christian working in a casino and, you know, that she seems to think that there's, you know, that I'm just around a bunch of, you know, drunk people gambling and
mm-hmm. Well, one simple question is, if you were just around a bunch of drunk people gambling, is that non-Christian in itself? Is it un-Christian to be around drunk people gambling?
I don't believe so.
Oh, I don't think so either. You know,
yeah.
I'm wondering,
yeah.
Jesus was around a bunch of, you know, bad guys.
Right, exactly, and I just from listening to your show, I've been able to you know come back with some questions, you know, using the Columbo tactic, and I've been able to, you know, pretty much stump her when it comes to, you know, the questions that I'm asking, but to her it's just like it just doesn't seem, you know, right for me. So I just didn't know you know what your take on Christians being in an industry where you normally wouldn't find, you know, Christians actually.
Yeah, I guess. First of all, I wouldn't be surprised that there aren't a lot of Christians that are in that industry. I can see how it's an odd industry. I mean, it's. I can see how it'd be questionable to some people, just like Christians working at a bar or working for Anheuser-Busch or working
exactly.
in the entertainment industry. But I guess I'd have to ask some very straightforward questions. What specifically is the immorality that is associated with working in that industry? And in what specific way is it wrong? Why would it be unchristian? Now, if you were a drunk or somebody addicted to gambling, I can see how that would be unchristian. But not everybody who goes to one of those casinos. Are you in Las Vegas?
No, I'm actually in San Diego.
Okay.
I'm a card dealer at one of the casinos.
Okay, well, so same difference. And I mean, if you eat, whether you're there or Las Vegas, wherever, if you, I don't, you know, a lot of, you know, that everybody that's there is not addicted to gambling. Everybody that's there is not a hooker. Everybody that's there is not drunk. You know, you've got a mixture of people in that industry, like you do in a lot of industries. Now, I think that there are some places of employment that maybe expose you a little bit more to vice than others, and that means if you're going to work in those environments, you're going to have to be more on your guard. But that would be true about like maybe like used car lots or something like. I mean, there are a lot of businesses that have vice in them, if you think of the full range of kind of, who knows, maybe you could be working for Microsoft and that could be dangerous in light of the people that are around you and the ideas that they hold. So the Christian, I think, needs not to be careful not to engage in immoral activity or to directly promote it. Like if you were, you know, a film man for pornography, I would say that's beyond the pale, you know.
Right, right.
Because the industry itself is an example of vice. But, you know, I've gone to casinos. I mean, I've pulled the one-armed bandits, although it doesn't really have much appeal to me. But I have Christian friends that, as a matter of recreation, and go to those places. I think it's kind of fun to walk around Las Vegas. You know, it's pretty opulent and neat looking, and there are attractions in a sense for family, whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't see anything wrong in principle with working at those places. So someone would have to bring up more than that. Pardon me?
Yeah, I don't even gamble. So
yeah, see, there you go.
Not so like this a vice for me just being there.
Right. Now, there are some vices close by, and you may need to, you know, be alert to that and do what you can to avoid those, but that's going to be true about any business that a person is in. There is temptation to vice. So,
Well, my other question, my girlfriend told me that at her church in New York, they spoke on the screams coming from the center of the earth on a big excavation
in Siberia.
Exactly, right.
Yeah,
I know it's been circulating for a long time.
Yeah, I know about this story.
Yeah, they actually played the tape in for the church.
Yeah.
And it, you know, freaked everybody out and, you know.
Okay, now let me ask.
True.
Okay, now this goes to Christians' gullibility.
Right.
Christians are incredibly gullible, especially if there's something spiritual associated with it. We are not inclined to be as distrustful of something that claims to be genuinely spiritual. I talked about this a little bit last hour with somebody who asked questions about Pentecostalism, and I said, you know, of the people, Pentecostals, pardon me, are most, in a sense, in awe of God's, you know, miraculous power, but they're the ones, I think, who take it least seriously because they believe everything. And they don't question anything. And this actually tells me that they don't take it seriously at all. And so here you've got this, you know, this account of somebody drilling in Siberia, and they broke through in the shaft, and they could hear, smell sulfur fumes and feel heat coming up, and they heard screams. And they stopped work at this site because they presumed this was screams of people in hell. And then this got circulated, of course, and a lot of people are, you know, heard about it and thought it was true. Now, just an observation. Do your friends, or does your girlfriend's friends at this church, do they actually believe that hell is in the center of the earth?
I think, yeah, she's actually nodding at me right now. Yes,
actually believe that if you dug down, do they think if you take a spaceship and you go high enough, you could probably make it to heaven? I mean, this is silly.
Right.
I mean, hell is not a physical location in the physical universe.
Right.
I mean, that's first thing. In any event, this story is a complete hoax.
Right.
It was a hoax that was created by somebody who wanted to see how far loony Christians would take it before somebody checked it out. And the person who checked it out finally was Rich Bueller, who used to work right at this radio station, KBRT.
Oh.
And Rich checked it out, and when he finally he tracked down the rumor, the source of the rumor, and when he finally got a hold of the guy said, "Finally, somebody has asked me whether it was true." Up until this time, everybody took it for granted it was true, and nobody checked it out. And so Rich posted this on his website that he's, I don't know, maybe since developed since then. And it's his website is called truthorfiction.com. And on that website, you can find out about all kinds of urban legends, including spiritual ones, like the one I just got an email from by friends of mine who are smart people. But they advanced it to me about and a whole bunch, everybody on their list because they were told to. It's kind of like a Christian chain letter about how they're going to take all the Christian broadcasting off the networks. And they said, focus on the families involved with this, and this is a Proposition 2935 or whatever, they had the number on it. So I just took the number, just the four-digit number, and Googled it and came up immediately with all these references saying how this thing is a hoax, how Focus on the Family is saying it's a hoax, and how truthorfiction.com has all the skinny on it. And this is one that's been going around for a long time. But it's amazing what Christians
people, I'm sorry. If you
go ahead.
Send it to nine people, then the broadcast will stay up, right?
Pardon me?
If you send it to nine people. Then...
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. Because they're gathering signatures against us, and pretty soon they're going to. But there were other things that were connected to it, and we wouldn't be able to worship. I mean, it was kind of ludicrous on its face. Now, one thing to look for in these things is, first of all, just think about the proposition itself. Think about the claim that's being made and ask yourself, does this sound a little loopy? Yeah, they dug a hole in Siberia and they broke through to hell and the fumes were coming up and they heard people screaming. Wait a minute, how do you hear people screaming down like 2 miles of shit? You know, it's just crazy. Secondly, there are no specifics. It doesn't say the Yuri Gagarin mining company on April 23rd of last month of last year broke through at the city of such and so, da 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 da, and AP has, you know, the writer has such and so. There's no specifics. There's nothing to follow up on. Now, in the case of this one that I got just recently, at least I could follow up on the proposition number. And when I followed up on the only particular that identified this thing, I found out immediately that it was a hoax, although it seemed pretty hokey to me when I just thought about it. So another thing that will indicate that something's hoaxy.
Yeah.
Is that there's not much detail. So you want to look for detail. And I suggest going to truthorfiction.com and just perusing some of the funny stories.
Yeah, I went to Answers in Genesis and found that on there also.
Okay.
If you've been to that site, it's...
The one about hell, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was able to find something there, but I wasn't sure if you had a...
No, the irony about that story is that the guy fabricated on purpose just to see how far goofy Christians would go. And I bet you dollars to donuts, now I could be wrong, but your friend is sitting there, right? Was that a charismatic church that played that?
Yeah, semi. I've been to it, and it, you know, I've...
Pentecostal, whatever?
Yeah.
I just think people in Pentecostal churches, God bless them, are more gullible. Because they have an inordinate openness to this kind of things, an inordinate, unquestioning acceptance of anything spiritual.
Right.
So, and that's a danger for them. So does that help?
Very much. Thank you very much, Greg, and Merry Christmas to you and your family. And
thank you.
Over there at STR.
That's very kind of you, Zeb. The same to you and yours.
All right. Bye-bye, Greg.
Bye-bye. 1-800-227-5278. Do we have a break coming up? Yeah, we'll take it right now. And more calls in just a moment.
For 2,000 years, the Church has been standing strong in a desperate battle for the souls of men. Each era has its own particular challenges or battlefield, yet our means and weapons should always be the same. Yet what is unique about today's conflict is that much of the Church is fighting the wrong battle with the wrong weapons. In this two-lecture set, Greg calls the Church back to the basics of genuine spiritual warfare. Truth encounters, not power encounters. From truth to experience. Why the Church is losing its vitality in the 21st century is this important teaching. Call 1-800-2-REASON to order, 1-800-2-REASON, or go to the web at str.org to order From Truth to Experience.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
That night, holy night, all is come, all is bright, round yon virgin mother and child. Oh,
Greg Kokel back with you here in our last segment of the show, in our last show before Christmas. Let's go to Billings, Montana, and this is Kurt. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Doing great.
Good. I normally call from Tucson. I'm up here on vacation.
Mm.
So,
are you skiing up there in Montana?
I don't ski.
Oh, okay. What's on your mind today, Kurt?
A little cooler than Tucson, but I consider myself a skeptical agnostic Christian.
A skeptical agnostic Christian, okay.
Long story, but I just thought I'd just give you where I'm coming from.
All right. I'm not sure I can make sense out of that, but that's all right. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'll do my best here.
And I've been going through different periods of, you know, dips and lows, dips and highs of atheism and back up to Christianity. I've kind of settled down in the middle, I think, now for quite some time.
Is it kind of like being half pregnant? Like, well, in the middle between Christianity and atheism?
What I do is I accept Christianity, and I still keep a lot of the things that I was brought up with. I like a lot of the music, keep up with.
Oh, some of the social trappings.
Shows like yours. I like Hillsong Church in Australia, that type of church.
Okay. Well, what's your question? You
know, okay, just where I'm coming from. One thing I have a problem with, and I don't have a closed mind. I'm still trying to find an answer.
Okay.
That's why I said I'm a skeptical agnostic Christian, because I like to, I just have a hard time accepting some things. And one of the things here, and I told your call screener this, was in the Bible when the Pharisees asked Jesus for a sign, and he said no sign will be given except for the sign of Jonah, which I assume is the resurrection. Is that right?
Right, that's right.
Okay. Problem I have with this is, why didn't Jesus, after his resurrection, appear to the Pharisees and show them so that he was resurrected?
Right. Well, this is
what he told them he would do.
Right. It's sometimes difficult to navigate through the sayings of Jesus and try to figure out what was Jesus in Jesus' mind. My general approach is I give Jesus the benefit of the doubt. That is, I think of him charitably. I think, well, he's not a nut. He's a clever guy that was nuanced and mysterious in some ways. So what might be what was going on here when he said certain things or he did some things? And I can conjecture with my imagination a little bit, giving him the benefit of the doubt, okay? And I think that's always fair with a guy like Jesus. So he says, I won't give you any sign except for the sign of Jonah, the resurrection. Now, and then you say, why didn't he go back to these guys? Well, he did go back to them in one sense. That is, those who he commissioned to communicate the message went back to the leadership and proclaimed the resurrection that Jesus predicted. Jesus himself didn't go back to them, but he didn't need to. He sent his representatives to do that. So he was straightforward about continuing to communicate the message. He just sent those that he commissioned to take the message. And he only appeared to those, with a few exceptions, he only appeared to those afterwards who were already believers. The exceptions were some of his brothers, James, for example, and Paul, James, who wrote the book of James, and Paul, Saul of Tarsus, he did appear to, but for the most part, he didn't go back to them. Now, keep in mind that these are people who saw Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead. So they had a sign of a resurrection and still did not believe. Pardon me?
Okay. As far as there was a lot of magicians back in those days, and everybody was, you know, there's a lot of people doing signs and miracles. It's pretty clear in the Bible and other sources back then that Jesus was not the only one who was performing miracles.
Yeah, I don't know that it was as common as that, first of all.
We could go into a long discussion about whether or not Lazarus was really dead and all that. But
let me ask you a question.
The fact is whether or not they're supposed to accept the resurrection on somebody else's word. If somebody told you that they were at a Benny Hinn concert or a Benny Hinn concert, Benny Hinn crusade, and seen miracles happen, do you think it would be proper of God to exclude you from hell because of some secondhand information?
Well, no. It all depends, I guess I'd have to say.
But that's the same situation they were in.
No, it isn't the same. You're comparing. If somebody just said he saw miracles at Benny Hinn, and that was it, okay, well, then I'd be skeptical until I got more information, but I wouldn't completely write it off. Pardon me?
anybody, even maybe somebody who's more reputable.
Okay, I would be.
I mean, it's difficult for us to believe in, you know, things like that of the supernatural. If I saw a UFO or Santa Claus.
Yeah, it's difficult, but it's not impossible. And Santa Claus is a different situation. See, the idea that there's, when Jesus works miracles, he does it as the Son of God, okay? That there is a God who can influence the world is certainly rational, okay? That there's a guy who flies around in a sleigh is a whole different story, you know, who drops gifts every once in a year. So it isn't in the same category.
Either. Raising somebody from the dead isn't rational either. That's why we call it a miracle.
Well, wait a minute. There's nothing irrational about it.
That's what we call it, a miracle.
Kurt, you gotta we don't have enough time, as it turns out, to get into a lot of details on this because we've got a couple minutes here. But the thing is, we've got to play by a certain set of rules when you're working through circumstances like this. You're trying to equate something like a miracle of a resurrection with Santa Claus. And I'm saying, look, there are two different – there is a larger worldview within which it makes sense to have something like a miracle of a resurrection. Which larger worldview, a theistic worldview where God intervenes, even though it's strange and unusual and miraculous, there is a coherence and a cohesiveness in that. There is no worldview with the same kind of parallel support for it that affirms the existence of a Santa Claus in the same way. So that's why they're two different worlds. And when you're looking at things, you're not just looking at a claim of a resurrection and a claim of a fat guy with a suit and reindeer. These are different kinds of things entirely, and just because both of them are kind of extraordinary doesn't mean they're on par. You have to look at these other details in particular, and people don't go to hell just because they didn't believe that some guy rose from the dead. That's what you said a few moments ago. That's a misunderstanding of the Christian doctrine. One can believe that Jesus is the one that rescues from sin if they take the entire corpus of evidence in favor of him. The historical evidence, the teaching of Jesus, the prophecies pertaining to him, the Old Testament, the worldview that's represented, and sees how it fits together. And then they have very good reason to believe in that.
Okay. And I would agree with a lot of that what you're saying as far as the teachings of Jesus, but where I would separate from you from, and I think where you separate a lot of what your beliefs are, and I have a tendency to hold more to the Bishop Shelby Spong viewpoint. I know you've called him an atheist and all that, but I don't think...
Well, he is an atheist.
I don't think you really understand his viewpoint. If you read it, you probably would, but this is where I would separate my views from yours. I agree with all those things that Jesus said, but I don't necessarily believe that he was a God in the sense that you claim to... that he is a God.
Well, I'm believing God, in the sense that
he claimed. The Spirit of God like we all can have.
Well, that isn't what he said. That is not being fair with his claims. He didn't leave that open to us, as C.S. Lewis has put it so well.
He appeared before the Pharisees that were asking him for a sign.
Say that again?
Then he should have appeared before.
No, there is no should about it. He doesn't have to jump through your or my hoop in order to prove himself true just because he didn't do the thing that you wanted him to do. The thing that we have is we can look at the things that he actually did do that we have good reason to believe were the case, and just because and draw conclusions about his identity and his claims and everything from that, just because he didn't jump through an additional hoop that you would have liked doesn't mean that he isn't who he claimed to be.
A very big hoop.
It doesn't matter.
That he should have jumped through.
It doesn't matter. He already jumped through big hoops that he didn't jump through another big hoop. You know, frankly, anybody who looks at all the evidence, I have a feeling that if Jesus would have appeared to the Pharisees and said, look, it's me, here's your sign of Jonah, that still wouldn't have been enough for you. You would have still come up with a reason to be skeptical of that account. You would have come up with some other reason. Why didn't he have them put their fingers in his, you know, nail prints then? He did that with Thomas.
Why was he persuaded by the evidence? Why would the Pharisees be an exception? You're just making an off-cuff remark.
No, I'm not. I'm not at all.
Why did Thomas then? Why was he convinced when he put his hand in his side? He was just predisposed to disbelieve also until he seen it.
He wasn't predisposed in the same way that the Pharisees were. I mean, that's pretty clear because he was walking with Jesus the whole time.
I will not believe until I put the hands in his side.
In the resurrection. Okay, so?
That's what he said. That's what Thomas said.
Okay, and Jesus decided to meet Thomas there, and he decided not to put himself through the same thing with the Pharisees. That's up to him. Just because he didn't do it with you or me either.
No.
Now, if you had done it with all those guys and he didn't show up at your bedside and say, stick your finger into my palm, then you still could have said, well, why didn't he do it with me? Therefore, that's not enough evidence. I'm not satisfied. Jesus should have done it to me as well. Why wouldn't you say that? Why would you stop at the Pharisees if he had done that?
There's all kinds of miracles from everybody claiming miracles. And first and foremost, that's not a very good reason to believe something anyway, just based upon some sort of a trickery, which...
Well, it presumes that it's trickery, and there's a lot more to it than just the miracle. This was part of a whole web of things that included miracles, of course, attesting miracles, and it also included the person of Jesus himself and the fulfilled prophecy and all of that stuff. We're not just isolating one thing.
I would disagree with you, because I don't think those are very good arguments. I mean, I know you're doing the best you can with it.
Okay,
but
fair enough. Yeah, I'm limping along here on my evidences. Okay, Kurt.
I like you as a person, Greg. You're doing a good job that way.
Thank you. I hope you keep listening in. I got to run, though. We got other callers.
Right.
Thanks a lot, Kurt. By the way, I forgot to mention the Master Series of Christian Thought. I did mention it last hour, but I want to reaffirm this. Starting January 9th, that's in about 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks, whatever. Through February 6th, we have our annual Master Series of Christian Thought meeting at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. It goes from 7 to 9:30, and we get the best speakers that we can for 5 weeks to give you a real challenging evening of Christian speakers and interaction. January 9th, Jay Budziszewski, What We Can't Not Know. January 16th, Dr. Frank Beckwith, Sex in the City, that would be SECTS, The Problem of Believing Something. January 23rd, Dr. J. Wesley Richards, The Death of Materialism, Evidence of Intelligent Design from Cosmology to Capitalism. January 30th, Dr. Paul Meyer, Christianity, the First Three Centuries. And then finally, February 6th, I will be anchoring the series with Truth is a Strange Sort of Fiction, Understanding the Emerging Culture. That is a great lineup. We try to do our best every year, and we have a great turnout for that usually. So I just want to let you know about it. You can put it on your schedule. The cost for the 5 sessions is $30. If you want to come to just individual sessions, you won't get such a good value. They're $7 each. Seating's limited, so I suggest that you pre-register. You can call Hope Chapel at Hermosa Beach, which is where we meet every season. 310 is the area code, 374-4673. You can call to register and to get directions, and you can also go to our website at str.org or call us at Stand to Reason at 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's January 9th through February 6th, 7 to 9:30 in the evening, the Master Series of Christian Thought. Friends, I hope you have a great week. My wife and I are slowing down this week, and we're just going to do Christmas our way. Focus in as we ought, and we hope you can do it as well. Have a great Christmas, and give them heaven, okay, friends? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Take care.